Hi, everybody. Sorry we're a few minutes late, but thanks for joining us. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar on a very important topic, what you can and can't do when skip tracing accounts. In today's world of people sharing the most intimate details of their lives on Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, or Twitter, it can be hard to know what you can and can't do when trying to find somebody. We're fortunate to have a panel of experts with us today who will share their insights and strategies with us. This webinar is being generously sponsored by Microbuilt. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit now about today's speakers. Ron Brown is the president and CEO of CSI Group in Oklahoma City, one of the oldest and largest asset recovery investigation agencies in the Central Plains region. A state licensed private investigator and member of the National Association of Fraud Investigators, he has more than 45 years of experience in the field of locating and recovering lost and missing people and assets, and has assisted many law enforcement agencies, including the Marshal Service, the FBI, and the Texas Rangers. He's received the ACA International Fred Kirshner Instructor Achievement Award for instructing more than 250 ACA seminars, and was also three times selected by ACA International as the Certified Instructor of the Year. David Linares heads up the legal and compliance team at DCI, along with other several support areas within the organization. David is well versed in both the regulatory and legal landscape, as well as operations and its challenges, having led teams in both realms. Able to draw from his experience, David develops his teams to rely on forward-thinking methodologies in order to face industry challenges head-on while adjusting to the ever-changing minefield that is the ARM regulatory landscape. Kelly Parsons O'Brien is a third-generation debt collector, having worked for the family business since 1994 when she was a freshman in high school. Kelly currently serves as president for the California Association of Collectors. Actually, she was past president of the California Association of Collectors. Sorry, I had to update that, Kelly. She's worked diligently to learn every aspect of the business in her over 23 years as credit bureau associate and now Pacific Credit Services. Kelly has a passion for skip tracing, having spent many hours learning the skills of searching for people and talking to third parties to gain location information. Dwayne Wells has been at Credit Solutions LLC in Lexington, Kentucky for 8 years. For the past 5 years, he has been the trainer, and for the past 6 years, he's overseeing the collections department at the collection agency. The format for today's webinar will be a discussion moderated by myself. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them when the webinar or the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available in the coming days on AccountsRecovery.net. Finally, this event is an audio-only event, so if you're not seeing anything on your screen, you're not missing anything. So with that, let's begin the discussion. Let's start at a very broad level of what we're talking about, what sort of you can, or what are the laws that regulate what you can and can't do as it relates to skip tracing? And maybe, Kelly, you want to take a first crack at that.
So, I mean, I guess the first thing that comes to mind in my mind is the FDCPA. I ran out of time because it was on my notes to check the state law guide from ACA and look through there because I'm sure there are some state regulations. We collect mostly in California and Nevada, so I'm not as up on my 50, you know, my all the states. And so I know that there are some specific state laws, but the FDCPA was kind of the first thing that popped in my mind. The other thing that I'm kind of conscious about is staff, like harassment. And the reason I say that is because we don't have any of our staff do any social media searching. And a lot of that is just because of the images that they'll be exposed to on people's Facebook pages. California is really sensitive for, like sexual harassment or any type of harassment. And I felt like, you know, if we force somebody to go through their consumer social media and be exposed to those images, it may create an environment for our office, at least, that we might have some problems from that perspective. So that's kind of our take on it.
This is Ron Brown. You know, social media has become a big skip tracing tool, and different states do have different laws, like you mentioned there. However, the skip tracers are using social media, and it's amazing. I just finished a conference in Chicago, and I kind of gravitate towards the skip tracers. And the stories that I heard, how they had set up false IDs to get people, how they talked to them. Skip tracing on social media has to be a read-only program. And the people tell me, well, you know, I can't find them because they've got us blocked. What they don't understand is you don't look at them. You look at their friends, and you look at what the friends are saying. How do you like your new job at? How do you like living in? And that's how you locate the people rather than looking at their direct Facebooks. We don't seem to have a problem with it in Oklahoma or with any of the people that I've spoke to. And as I say, especially with the cyber trackers, that's become one of the biggest ways there is to find people.
Yeah, I agree. And we have trouble. I will have trouble with common names. And so what I do is a relative search, because a lot of the people that are in collections generationally have named their children very uncommon names. And so it's often easier to find the, you know, kids from the 18 to 25 range on Facebook. And usually their parents are their friends. And then you can get the information that you're looking for there as well. So for us, when you're trying to find somebody, looking at those relatives and associates on your whatever searching you're doing all oftentimes helps you find the person you're looking for.
You know, one thing I'm finding is that we're seeing more and more millennials enter into the collection and the skip tracing industry, and they don't communicate. They don't like to talk to each other. I've got two granddaughters, and a while back they were sitting on the couch, one on each hand, and they're, you know, they're thumbers. You can spot these millennials. They thumb instead of one finger. And I asked them what they were doing. They said texting, and I asked them who, and they said each other. They don't want to talk anymore. And one thing that worries me about the traditional skip tracing, being able to talk to people, relatives, references, without breaking the laws, without violating Section 804 of the FDCPA, without doing that, yet to extract the information from them using neurolinguistic techniques, it's becoming almost a lost art because of the different data gathering companies, and of course we have created those companies, the immediate need for information. They gather all the information for us, but I know, you know, we use four or five different products to track people, and when it comes down to talking to get information, it's becoming, like I say, a lost art.
David, as someone who's coming at this from the compliance side, maybe you can sort of talk a little bit about what the boundaries are, or what you're looking at from a regulatory standpoint in terms of the skip tracing that your collectors or that your company, you know, the agency is doing.
Yeah, definitely. So, of course, the FDCPA is always the main hurdle whenever it comes to skip tracing. Depending on the products that you're utilizing and whether you're using them in batching, or if you have some of your agents have access to products that may dig into soft inquiries on a consumer's credit, then you're definitely falling into the realm of the FCRA when you're trying to skip trace someone. And not to mention that if you're associating a skip trace phone number to a dialer or anything along those lines, then you might be jumping into the realm of the TCPA if you're not controlling it properly. So the name of the game for us here, because we also have many, many tools to skip trace, and we play with social media, but very lightly, like Ron was saying, from the private end, making sure that it's entirely invisible, no communication or outbound communication from our end, is the controls, right? Your procedures, your policies, whatever you set in place to skip trace is only as good as the control that you have in place behind it to make sure that your agents are staying within the guidelines of the FDCPA, within the guidelines of the FCRA, and it's all very sensitive. So we choose to keep it to a very small controlled group that we know that we can monitor very closely, and we know can effectively get us what we need for the rest of the company, because skip tracing really boils down to your need, in my mind, right? If you have inventory that calls for file collectors, skip tracing is going to be much more prevalent on the agent side versus when you have kind of a pooled environment and you rely on the companies like the TransUnions of the world and the TLOs to give you this information in batch format. So,
you know, I certainly agree with that, and this small pool of trained tracers that you're talking about, you have to be very, very careful. Again, some of the people that I talk to, they, they'll go way out on a tangent, creating false IDs to be able to get information and talk to people. And that's something in the collection industry we cannot do. We've got very strict laws. We have to be very careful. Also, a person is skip tracing and talking to a parent or a relative or something would even mention something to the effect that, well, you know, I know they used to be on disability, or I know that anything medical related can fall under HIPAA, and you're divulging that information. So the tracers have to be very, very closely trained in laws. And I think that is one reason that cyber tracking is becoming a more prevalent thing. As long as you're not talking to anybody, as long as you're not going to credit bureau records or anything like that that would have to do with the FCRA or FACTA, then actually there's no law out there. As long as it's read-only, 24/7, 365 from any place that there's a computer, and today's kids coming out of high school are so computer literate, that's becoming very prevalent among collection agencies. Investigation agencies, they develop their own team of cyber trackers, and it's these young kids coming in anymore that are really knowledgeable of the different data sites. And, you know, I'm familiar with, you know, Facebook and Twitter and things like that, but they come up with some sites that are unbelievable where they can extract information about people. And they were showing me a while back, any photograph they post on the internet has a embedded geophysical address in it, and how to extract that address out to tell exactly where that photograph was taken and the date it was taken. It's amazing what's out there.
Yeah, this is Dave. Just definitely agree with Ron. We have to, as this industry continues to evolve, we definitely have to start tapping into the younger, I guess the younger people coming out of the schools and that can track this stuff for us. I was having a conversation with a salesman not too long ago, and I'll keep from where the salesman was to myself, but I was having a conversation with a salesman, and he said that in this company specifically, they are training them on how to sell to millennials, and it's not conversational, it's not bringing them out to dinner, it's not any of the traditional sales tactics. It's really just forming an email with exactly what the product is that they're selling, what the benefit is, and then just letting it go and hope that they somehow find their way back to you, or they ask you a couple of questions and initiate a dialogue. So it definitely is, like we were saying before, becoming a lost art, but there is a new art forming in how to find these. And while social media is still largely unregulated, as long as you don't have any outbound going or it's all private or invisible, then it's definitely something to take advantage of.
Ron, I just wanted to circle back just to sort of reinforce a point that you've made a couple of times. When you talk about read only, what you're saying is as long as you see it, it's okay, as long as you're sort of not writing anything or publishing anything or trying to interact with somebody. Is that what you mean?
Yes. Yeah. So that would be it. It's, for example, LinkedIn has, it notifies anyone when you've viewed a profile, but there's an option within LinkedIn, for example, to search in private mode. So nobody would really know where that was coming from. Facebook, unless you initiate any sort of communication, and nobody would really know that you were on their page or anyone else's page. And as long as their profile is open enough to search, then you can find good nuggets of information.
You know, I find it unusual.
Yeah, go ahead, Ron. Go ahead.
I find it unusual. Of course, I've been an instructor with ACA International since about 1992. And skip tracing used to be one of the most requested classes there are. We're seeing fewer and fewer requests for actual the skip tracing class, more cyber tracking, but less skip tracing. And it just leads me to believe that the agencies today, through the access of all the data sources, the data brokers who gather the data, and then you can buy it and run either your batch search or your human search, that there's much more of a demand anymore for the cyber tracking end of it than that actual voice-to-voice skip tracing end of it. And the cyber tracking, again, you know, they like it because as long as you don't talk to anybody, you're not going to have any laws that you have to break. You don't have to train the people in laws. And you can mitigate that risk that's out there anytime you have a skip tracer talking to a third party. There's always the risk that they're going to break the law, and, you know, inadvertently. But by cyber tracking, you don't have to worry about that at all.
Dwayne, wanted to get your input and get you involved in the discussion here. Curious, can you talk a little bit about how social media is or isn't used at your agency when it comes to skip tracing or trying to find people, and sort of maybe talk about some of the rules you have in place if you do allow it.
Well, typically at our agency, we have a limited amount of people that have access to that sort of skip tracing ability. We still stick to some of the old style, making the phone calls to some neighbors nearby, especially in our department with if we're going to seek litigation. But a lot of times we stick with LinkedIn or Facebook otherwise, basically in read-only. People want to share every bit of their information out there, from whether they're cooking at night or everything, man. So you can find where they're working pretty easily through those two avenues in what we do here. Are you there?
And then once you do find where someone's working, is the next step to sort of initiate a conversation there, or what do you do with that information once you've got it?
Yeah, we initially try to get a conversation with them at that point. And if at that point everything breaks down, then obviously we move to doing what we need to get the consumer's account taken care of in our office, whether that means through litigation or, you know, whatever means we need to do.
I also think I've had a few success stories with Yelp. It's another one that people, you know, tell you where they're at, they tell you what they're doing. And I think that it's another kind of tip if you're looking for somebody to kind of understand what their habits are, often tells you a little bit more about what they're doing. And of course, some of this stuff that we're talking about, I think that it really has to be balance warranted, right? So if I'm searching for a large judgment or even a large open account, the extra research and effort to find out where they're doing, we deal with, you know, we sue quite a bit of people. So we have quite a bit of bad serves, right? So we think we know where they're at. We file a lawsuit. And so understanding kind of a little bit more about what their habit is, you know, where's their favorite place for lunch? Like, I know that they work for Kaiser Hospital, but I don't really know, you know, what their regular habits are. And if I knew, you know, this is where they go regularly for lunch, it might give the process server a better opportunity to get them served.
That's good to know.
Okay. At this point, I just want to pause the discussion for just a minute and talk a little bit about the sponsor of today's webinar, and that's MicroBuilt. For more than 35 years, MicroBuilt has been helping businesses assess and manage risk. They were a pioneer in the now exploding alternative credit data space, and as such have refined their products and services to deliver true business value. Over the years, MicroBuilt has invested heavily in acquiring best-in-class data. They've built sophisticated systems for keeping their data fresh and accurate, and powerful predictive models for making decisions around lending, leasing, collections, and risk management. With MicroBuilt, you can customize the products you need and how much you want to spend. And all of their products are provided through a single, simple access portal. Whether you're working in originations or debt collection, screening a potential hire or tenant, planning for growth, or keeping up with regulatory requirements, MicroBuilt can be your partner, providing the insight and information you need to protect your business, grow your bottom line, and keep your company running smoothly. For more information, please contact MicroBuilt at 1-800-884-4747 or visit www.microbuilt.com, and that's spelled MicroBuilt.com, microbuilt.com. Thanks again to MicroBuilt for sponsoring today's webinar. And with that, let's pick up with our discussion. David, I think I was going to, was I interrupting you when I started that?
I'm sorry. Can you say that again?
I thought I was interrupting you when I started talking a little bit about the sponsor, and I wanted to make sure that I gave you the chance to say what you had on your mind if you were going to say something.
No, not at all. No, I wasn't talking.
No problem. One of the things we've talked a little bit about so far is making sure things are in read-only mode, and maybe what I'd like to do is get a sense from the panel where they thought, you know, or an example or an idea of what might be considered to be over the line when it comes to skip tracing an account. You know, how do you sort of determine where that boundary is between what's allowed and what's not allowed? Dwayne, we can start with you this time.
Well, I think anything that we do that's not deceptive would be, that's the toughest point is, you know, doing things when you're speaking to people. I'm a little more old school when I started doing this, is more of the skip tracing and actually making the phone calls to people and trying to gather that information. So not being deceptive, you know, using the correct technique, like what Ron was saying earlier, is kind of the route that I like to go. I mean, I like all the Facebook and all those type of things, but I'm a little more, I guess, old school and learned it from my mentors that, for me, that's the way that I always skip trace. It's nice to have those social media sites and those sort of things, but I'm still old school. I like making the call to people and gathering that information that way.
But you know, go ahead, Ron. Sorry, go ahead.
We use a waterfall technique when we're skip tracing. And obviously with agencies today and the different rates, you know, we'll start out with what we term free sites. And if we can't find them on the social sites, the free sites, and get the information, then we'll drop down to the pay sites, the different data brokers that are gathering up the data for us, and we pay for that. But, you know, we have tracked that, the cost of it versus the recovery percentage. And it is like a waterfall. You gather at some at each level, but back to what was just said, and I agree, the prime level for the majority of the hard skips has got to be direct contact. And it's amazing, you know, you talk about the different laws and things. Actually, I like to listen to these people, and I was listening to one just a while back, and specifically, this collector prided himself, this tracer, in this technique he had developed where he would call the parents and tell them that a vehicle matching the description of their son, their daughter, their brother, their husband, had been involved in an accident and was going to be towed. A car had hit it, and it was going to be towed unless they could contact the owner. How could they contact the owner of that vehicle at that point, at that time, right then? And of course, you know, the most people are taught to tell the truth as we're children, and we believe that other people are telling the truth. So the parents or whoever they were talking to wouldn't hesitate to give out contact information. And this tracer was just bragging about this to a bunch of other people. And that absolutely is a violation of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And that's one area where I see people, a lot of these tracers, they just are not trained where to stop, and that they can't condone that. And their clients should realize that if they are caught doing something like that and the client knows it or has any idea, then, you know, they're going to be held liable for it also. So there should be very strict monitoring on the tracers that are doing telephonic contact with people.
Well, the question I wanted to ask for David, and since you shared your perspective too, Ron, to get maybe from you, is deceptive, you know, can be sort of subjective. You know, it's going to vary maybe by state, maybe by court jurisdiction, depending if there's a legal ruling. How do you sort of know when you're being, you know, when you're sort of getting to the line of being deceptive, or maybe when you've crossed the line of being deceptive?
It's, you know, go ahead, Ron.
We train our tracers. So many times when you're talking to third parties, you'll be asked a question like, well, is this about a bill? Is this about a debt? Do they owe you money? Who do you work for? And, you know, if you tell the people, I'm sorry, but under federal law, I can't give you that information, or I'm not going to give you that information, obviously, you're not going to get anything out of them at all. We teach a very advanced neurolinguistic technique there when someone says, are you calling about a bill? We repeat the question, are you calling about a bill? And then we would say something like, that's a very odd, strange, or unusual. Nobody wants to be odd, strange, or unusual. So we say, that's a very strange question. Why would you ask me that? And they will reply back to you. You know, we don't have to answer questions, but we're taught from the time we're in grade school up that we do. But they will answer that question. Well, I know that he lost his job and et cetera, or I know they moved. I know they're having trouble. I know somebody repossessed the car. And then you reply with another neurolinguistic word, just really. And the conversation moves on. You never had to answer their question. You actually gained information from them without giving them anything. So consequently, you know, that is a good technique to train your collectors. And then they're not going to be breaking law. They're not going to be saying things that they shouldn't say. That's one way that we do it.
Wow, that's really interesting. And that, you know, successful most of the time, a lot of the time. I mean, is that something that, you know, a fairly successful strategy?
I can't tell you that anything is 100% except one thing. Nothing is 100%. 90% of the time, and like I say, that's something that's an interrogation technique that we train. And I'm certainly not telling people don't answer questions, but if a question is asked that you can't answer, rather than building that barrier of I can't give you that information, you know, you just tell them that's a very strange question. Why would you ask me that? And they will answer your question. And then, like I say, you just move the conversation on. 90% of the time, at least 90%, the people never realize that you didn't answer that question.
I think most of the time when people ask that question and you rebuttal with that, they're obviously wanting to spill everything they know about the person. And that's one of the reasons why you do call a neighbor or nearby or someone like that, because most people are willing to share as much information about somebody as they have without even knowing they're doing so.
I think, so is that the sort of technique that you – sorry, Kelly, is that the sort of technique that you used, Wayne, in trying to get people into sort of engaging in a conversation?
Yeah, for the most part. And you know, obviously that happens with actively listening to the third party or whoever you're speaking with. Because I think if you take your time and you say the right things back to them, then obviously they're going to give you the information you want to know. Because we're probably not the first person that's called them to even try to get that information. So obviously they're ready to get some sort of phone calls to stop so they can just be done with it.
Yep, and it's about really having that third party or that nearby, that neighbor, whoever it is, kind of buy into you as an individual and not just being robotic whenever you are skip tracing. I think a lot of the techniques that Ron was talking about and Dwayne was talking about would be very, very effective. We have similar things here, but really it's about turning the conversation always into making the third party feel like they're in control of that conversation when they're really not, right? Leading them in the direction that you want them to go. But it's very difficult to cross that line if you don't have a tight group of individuals that are doing your physical skip tracing or your P2P skip tracing. And, you know, like we talked about a couple of times here, we have to make sure that they're monitored very, very closely so that they stay within the confines and the bounds of what you've defined as acceptable within your organization. But, you know, one rule of thumb that we follow pretty consistently is if you don't know, don't say it. If it sounds wrong, don't say it. Just stick to the script that we've put together for you, and then developing a script that gets the most out of the individual that you may be talking to, and whatever technique that you utilize, it may find success. It's about A/B testing, right? Whatever your A is right now may not be your A in a week or in a month or 2 months from now as you continue to skip trace or you get into different demographics or geographical regions. So you just have to continuously test one technique against the other and utilize whichever is successful at the time.
You know, what I tell my skip tracers and even my collectors is like, we ask for payment in full on every call, right? And you're not going to get it every time, but that doesn't mean that you stop asking for it. You keep asking for it. And so the skip tracers, we talk about the same way. Like, you go into every call expecting you're going to get the information that you want, and you're going to ask for it every time. And I think that it may have been Ron that I actually heard this from, is people naturally want to tell the truth. And I know that we deal with people that are dishonest on a regular basis, so I think we get kind of jaded. But I think that if you teach your skip tracers that people want to tell the truth, they want to answer questions. They were taught to answer questions. And so when you're calling the mom or the neighbor or what have you, likely they're going to give you the information you want because you're catching them off guard. They're not professional liars. And, you know, sometimes they might be, the information might be a little guarded because they're not sure who you are, or what your intentions are, right? But ultimately they want to tell the truth and they want to answer your questions. And if you have that mindset going into the call, it makes it so much easier to get the information out of those people.
You know, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, there are so many subtleties to skip tracing. You know, our agency, I mean, that's what we're known for, is to be able to locate people and assets. And, you know, we find out little things like, you know, people will give more information to a skip tracer that's name ends in IE or Y. You know, Bobby, Mary, Judy, any name that ends in I, E, or Y. And so, you know, we want to know why. It's not the people that are successful that know how, it's the ones that know why. So we track that, and we started asking why. And obviously, when you give your name out over the telephone, it creates a word picture of who you are. I can be Ron. I can be Mr. Brown, and that's a word picture. I can be Ron, and that's a word picture. Or I can be Ronnie. And people will give more information to Ronnie. Why? Because it conveys the image of a young, non-threatening person. Little things like that, that just, you know, you train your people, and they don't have to break the law. They don't have to lie. They don't have to tell falsehoods to get information from people. The people want to give the information. You just have to know how to extract it to them. And what you say there is absolutely correct.
I'm sorry. I'm still trying to picture you as a Ronnie. David, I wanted to circle back to something you said during your last comments. You said, if you don't know, don't say it. Are you saying don't answer the question or don't say I don't know? I just wanted to sort of flesh that out a little bit.
Well, it's more along the lines of if you don't know the answer to what they're asking you, then it's perfectly fine to say I don't know, or to ask them for a second while you go get the answer to that question, or get the answer to, or get the right phrase to answer their question. Because I think one trap that we fall into, at least when you have skip tracers that are still in training, or people that are inexperienced, or people that you're bringing up from the ground, is that they tend to want to answer every question that they're asked right away. And no matter how much you might train someone, there's kind of that human instinct to always want to answer that question that you were asked right away. And that's when you might give out a little bit too much information. And so that's why I always say that if you don't know, don't say it. Take a moment, take a pause, either return the question or ask them to hold for a second while you get information. And when that happens, you might lose that call. You might not be able to extract the information from that third party that you just spoke to. But I would much rather we lose that skip attempt than create any liability.
And I agree with that 100%. You know, answering questions is something you think about it. When you're a young child, your parents are telling you, hey, look at me, I'm talking to you, you better answer me. Always tell me the truth. I won't punish you, just tell me the truth. We get into grade school, we get into high school, we get into college. What is a test? A test is nothing but a bunch of questions, and we get rewarded for answering those questions. So most people think that they have to answer questions. It's very important you train your skip tracers right off the bat, and even the collectors, that, you know, you don't have to answer every question. Under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, the only question you have to answer is, who do you work for? And, you know, a lot of times a tracer can feel, this person wants to give me information, but I'm not going to, they want to know, you know, who are you? Who do you work for? And, you know, and a lot of times, you can kind of lead them. You know, I'm sorry, but, you know, under federal law, or if you want to be a little clearer, under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, now they know it's about a debt. There's only certain information I can give you. I've given you my name. I've advised you this is about a personal business matter. I can tell you who I work for if you ask me. And then they're going to ask, well, who do you work for? And I work for Collection Services International, representing Baptist Hospital. Now, you have pretty much been able to convey what this call is about to the other person. And maybe it's a parent, maybe it's, you know, whoever, and that takes good collector knowledge and good ability to understand this is a case where I can do that. You have gone right to the line, and we talk about stepping over the line. Well, you haven't broken the law, but let me tell you, you have gone right to the fiery precipice and looked over into the flames, but you haven't broken the law. You have to be careful. And again, you know, only very experienced collectors can use techniques like that. Only very experienced skip tracers. Otherwise, and I agree totally with what I just heard, on every one of my skip tracer and collectors field screens, CRTs, there's a little note up there that says, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question. I will find out and get back to you. And we preach exactly the same thing you just heard. If you don't know 100%, the answer to a question or whether something's right or wrong, don't do it. Don't say it. That's the only safe harbor.
Agree totally.
Kelly, I wanted to follow up on something that that you mentioned before, and also because it's the next discussion topic I wanted to bring up. That is the amount of work that should go into skipping an account. And I'm going to guess it's relative to the amount of the debt. It might be relative to the client you're working for. But I'm curious if I could get some, you know, some of your perspectives about how you sort of manage that balance.
So I was thinking about this, and when you asked it, and I was like, well, you know, am I doing too much? Am I not doing enough? So we have a full-time skip tracer. We have like 15 collectors in our office, and we have a full-time skip tracer. And I was thinking about, she's averaging about 125 accounts a day. She makes about $14 an hour. So that's 88 cents every time she touches an account to do her searches. So she's updating phone numbers, addresses, maybe socials, date of births, that type of thing. And so I'm like, well, that kind of seems like a lot. But then I thought about it. I'm like, well, along with updating all that information, she's also making sure validation notices go out. She's also checking to make sure data entry entered the right information, right? Correcting misspellings or maybe a wrong name on a document or on an account. And so for me, I felt like maybe what I should be looking at is my skip tracer also does a lot of compliance work for me. And that 88 cents an account actually is a pretty good deal for compliance check and a skip trace. So for us, when I looked at kind of what we do, she's doing more than one job and still getting through a fair amount of accounts per day. And I think you could do the automation, but I'm not going to get the compliance check, which is really important in my office.
Got it. Curious, you know, sort of Dwayne, David, Ron, you know, how do you sort of manage that balance between how much skip work you're going to do versus, you know, whether or not it's going to be sort of worth the investment in spending that time?
We have a saying in our office, sometimes the pleasure just ain't worth the pain. That's an old cowboy saying. You know, we look at the size of the file, and we actually set parameters with our tracers, what they can do. There is a formula that they use, not only the dollar size of the file, but also the percentage that we're working the file at. What's the return going to be? We do not allow our collectors, and our collectors, we have a team of skip tracers, but the collectors do a limited amount. We don't allow them to skip trace and collect at the same time. They'll work for maybe 15, 20 minutes, and they find somebody, and they're feeling great about it. They've got a great nose up attitude. They call the person on the phone. The person gives them bankruptcy case number. Immediately, that attitude goes into a nosedive. So we will give them a certain period of time a day for that collector to skip trace. And then once they have skip traced on whatever number of files they get during that hour period or 2 hour period, then they'll make their collection calls, realizing, as it was mentioned before, I think by Kelly, you know, a good collector collects 3 out of 10 accounts. They bat 300 just like a good baseball player. Well, when they're skip tracing, if they start getting this nose down attitude, they quit skip tracing. They don't feel positive about it. And they have to maintain that positive mental attitude through the skip tracing and the collection process. And that's something that, you know, you look at the dollar size of the file, what the return is, and then you set up a formula. This is what you're going to do on this size file, this size file, this size file, factoring in the percentage that we're going to, you know, work the file at. It's the way we do it in our office.
Yeah, and I think that especially like for our social media searches, we're the same way. So the collector can refer an account to like a internet search if the balance is over like 20,000. And then all of our judgments go through some type of social media search or internet search, because Google is a powerful resource. I think that you know, Ron was talking about cyber tracking, and really a decent Google search on a name that's not very common is pretty powerful amount of information that you're going to find just on the first couple pages of Google. So that's one of the things that our judgment collectors do automatically. And I like the idea that Ron just suggested of not having them skip trace and collect in the same time. I think it also helps you kind of put the skip tracer hat on and then put the collector hat on. So, because I think it takes different type of communication when you're a skip tracer compared to when you're a collector.
Is there a? Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, here at our agency, you know, here at our agency, you know, basically our front-end collectors, you know, they'll skip trace, you know, places of employment or things of that nature based on, you know, a balance maybe around $1,000. But basically it's our end collector. When we've not been able to collect the account for a certain age, it goes to our, you know, basically kind of our legal clerk or special collection department. And then that's when we really dig down and try to find a place of employment and really do the skip tracing there if it's over a certain balance threshold. That way we can go on and get it out of our office if we can collect it via litigation, or we can collect it over the phone. If not, we want to be done with it and move forward. So that's kind of the way we do it here at Credit Solutions.
Yep. And then at DCI, we don't necessarily have any legal collections happening. We don't really pursue judgments. The majority of the inventory that we have is something that we would associate to a pool, and then we have some certain clients and corporate accounts that we have skip tracers that would go through and try to find this information for us. And we use the same approach. When they're skip tracing and only skip tracing. And that's scheduled out for a certain period of time, depending on the team and depending on the balance size, depending on the score that we got back when we initially sent it for due diligence scrubbing and that batch skip tracing through a vendor. But once we get it back, we understand that a lot of the information that we have may be outdated. And so, you know, there is a sense of accomplishment and there is a reward for the collectors when they're able to find and speak to the person that they've been trying to get in touch with. So typically, whatever file, and they're granted X number of files dependent on that criteria, that they skip trace, they keep. It's not something that they would skip trace and associate to someone else or to another agent to follow up on. That's a little bit here.
You know, good skip tracers,
yeah, go ahead,
I think, should develop, and we do this through forever, ever since I've been skip tracing. And, of course, you know, I have an advantage over a lot of people that are in the industry. I still skip trace. And when I'm in the office, I'm working, and skip tracing is what I do, and it's what I like to do. And, you know, there's open and closed sources of information. And when I teach classes, the Manhunt seminars, you know, I tell people, you know, everyone in this room has closed sources of information. People who will give you information, but they wouldn't give it to anybody else. I have credit unions and banks that I work with, and you know, you could call them to skip trace to try to get information. They'll give you absolutely nothing. But I can call them, and they'll give me the information. And every time I get someone's business card, I try to write down, you know, what type of business they're in, and when I met them, and where I met them, and something personal about them. A good professional tracer develops these sources. And, you know, a typical example, a while back, had a guy come in from Colorado. He had three trucks. They wanted the trucks located and repossessed. He was selling pipe, oil field pipe. I said, where does he live? In Oklahoma. Where does he work? In Oklahoma. That's all they knew, was he was in Oklahoma selling oil field pipe. I went back through my cards, and I had met a gentleman who is in the oil field pipe business. I called him. It's very odd because we don't have a lot of big lakes in Oklahoma, but he had a sailboat, and I had marked on the back of his business card he gave me about his sailboat. I asked him about his sailboat first. Men are bad about this. Women are very good. Women develop relationships with people. Men don't. Women will talk about their kids or baseball or something, and then they'll get into it. I've learned that from women. Watch women. They are great skip tracers. But I asked him about his boat and if he still had his boat and this and that. And then I asked him, by the way, do you know somebody named so-and-so? He's in the pipe business. He said, no, I don't. But if he's doing business in Oklahoma, I'll tell you who does. I called that person, and I used his relationship. John Doe told me to call you, that you could probably give me the information. And immediately, they knew who the guy was, where he was. So all good tracers should be developing closed and open sources of information and keep a record of that. So you can go back, and then that way we help each other. If I need somebody in Houston, Texas, I would call Millard Land. Millard's a friend of mine. He's a good skip tracer, probably one of the top skip tracers in the nation. Millard knows everybody in the Houston area. And we develop relationships like that. It makes us much, much better tracers.
Excellent tips. When you're looking for something, when you're skip tracing an account, are you looking for whatever the first piece of data is, place of employment, phone number, mailing address, whatever you can, and then you sort of stop, or do you look for it for a certain piece of information? Can you maybe talk a little bit about the process? And maybe, Kelly, you can go first this time.
I'm sorry, one more time, Mike. I think I lost part of that call, the question.
No, that's okay. When your when your SIP traces are working their accounts, what are they? Are they? Is there a priority in terms of the type of information they're looking for, or is it as soon as they get a new piece of information, they stop and try to work that? I'm curious what, you know, how the gathering process works.
So for us, phone number is number one. I mean, if I'm talking about like kind of all my accounts, if I can't talk to them, I can't collect from them. So phone's number one. Address would be number two, I think, on my list. And more from a perspective, we do a lot of property management debt and utilities. So most of the times we get the last known address, which we know is not current. So locating the new address. And then depending on the balance, my next kind of list is employment information. So knowing, you know, if the account warrants legal action, that I have an asset that I can enforce. So that's kind of, in my mind, the kind of the path that they go down. I think you'll have some other special cases in the large balance arena or in your judgment collections, because a lot of times in your judgment collections, it's not always just a simple wage garnishment. Sometimes it's going to require a little bit more effort in figuring out where their assets are and how to get them attached. So I think when you're dealing with your judgment collections, you know, where your assets are, you know, the bank account information and or where they're hiding their, you know, old cars that you can take and dispose, you know, pay, get sold off for money. So that's when it's kind of a unique situation, but I don't think it's the norm. So for me, it's the phone, address, and place of employment is the three top ones for us.
You know, not only are those the three top ones, and I agree with you completely, under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, Section 804, those are the only three things a collector is allowed to ask for: the resident's phone number, the resident's debt address, and the place of employment. Mike, if I called you and asked you, you know, where your brother worked, and you tell me, well, he works at Walmart. Well, there's 14 Walmarts in your city. If I ask you which Walmart or the phone number of that Walmart, I've actually broken the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. I can only ask you where he works. Once again, one of the subtleties, we train collectors, if we're looking for someone, we're trying to find employment, we may call their reference at noon or 1 o'clock. And we don't ask for the home phone number, and we don't ask for the employment number. We ask, is there a number I can reach them? In their mind, and again, it's neurolinguistic mind manipulation, it's 12 o'clock, what number can they be reached at? They will give you the employment number, but you did not ask for the employment number. You just asked for a number, and I meant the home number is what I meant. You know, a lot of little subtleties like that, but a lot of times collectors go way beyond that in asking more for more information, and, you know, trained skip tracers know those are the three things they can ask for, as long as they're driving for the home address, the home number, or the place of employment, then they're pretty much in a safe harbor, but they have to be careful how they ask it.
You know, and what one of the things that's really difficult in new hire training is I go over location information, right? I tell them what the FDCPA says, and then I ask a group of, you know, 3 to 6 people. I say, okay, well, now raise your hand for everybody that has a home phone number. And 9 times out of 10, nobody raises their hand in the room. And so it's really difficult for them to kind of understand. You mean I can't ask for their cell phone number, because that's the number that I know I need. And so we use the same thing, and I'm sure I learned it from Ron, is to ask for another number to reach them. But it's still kind of a weird concept for my new hires to kind of get in their mind that how old the FDCPA is, and that there could actually be phones hanging on a wall in a home. So,
Ron, I'm curious, just to sort of because I think it was a really good tip. We were talking a little bit before about sort of being deceptive and not being deceptive. Asking, is there a number I can reach them at, that doesn't fall under that sort of on the wrong side of that line?
I can tell you of no lawsuit that's ever been filed where someone asked, is there a number I can reach them? Okay. You do not have to specify, you know, can I have their home telephone number, or do you have their home telephone number? Again, as long as I do not specifically ask for anything other than their place of employment, if I ask for the employment phone number, I've broken the law. But if I'm just asking, is there a number I can reach them? I'm not asking for their employment number. I know of no one who's ever gotten in trouble for asking that. And we've been doing it since 1970, 40 years. That's the way we have skip traced.
And that's the way we've trained our tracers and never had a problem with it.
That's a pretty good track record. Well, we've got a few minutes left. We've got a bunch of questions that have come in from the audience. If you have a question, now would be a great time to type it in. We'll try and get to it before we run out of time. But I want to start to get to some of these questions here. The first question, in our business, when asked by a third party who we work for, we only give the initials. I thought the FDCPA said we couldn't identify ourselves.
It's very clear on that, Mike. If you're using initials like our company, we can either use CSI Group. Our company actual name is Credit Service Incorporated. We were incorporated in 1935, I think, but we trade name with the Secretary of State, CSI Group, and we also trade name Collection Services International that we do our collection work from. So the collector, and that's what it says on their paycheck, and it's very important that if you're using an acronym, it's on the paycheck, because when they get you on the stand, they'll ask you, who do you work for? What does your paycheck say? Well, ours says Collection Services International / CSI Group. So if I'm talking to a third party and they ask me, who do you work for? I can say CSI Group. I'm not divulging an indebtedness. What is CSI Group? Well, we're an asset management firm. If I'm talking to the consumer, I'll say, Collection Services International. So they know exactly what it's in regards to. Either one of those are trade names registered with the Secretary of State. If you're using an acronym and it is not a registered trade name, you can get in trouble over that.
Okay, good. Moving on. Our next question. Assuming you're utilizing a read-only approach with Facebook, is it recommended to have your employees create a fake profile or use their own?
They can set up a fake one, but I think the issue is if you set up a fake one, I think that you're risking, as long as they're not friend requesting, I think you're going to be fine. My concern has always been that if like an employee uses their personal one, that maybe they accidentally friend request. I mean, it's pretty hard to accidentally, but I mean, I guess my concern would be maybe having like an office one that was fake. But I think the biggest thing that we have to drive home is that you can't friend request them. You shouldn't be messaging them through Messenger. You really shouldn't be communicating them at all. I think what Ron said, read only, and that's really the best way. And I think one of the questions in the chat box was kind of you're against Facebook's policies and procedures or guidelines. And absolutely you are. I mean, I think that you by using Facebook as an opportunity to collect data about somebody, I think that you probably are against the guidelines, especially if you're setting up a fake one. I think that's something you're going to have to decide, risk reward kind of environment there.
Yep, and I can tell you that where we've, or the way that we do it here is we have kind of a business one that we utilize that we'll have our tracers log into when they're going to skip trips in Facebook. Something else that I've seen done before is, for example, me, David Linares, I will set up another David Linares profile that has none of my personal information in it or anything along those lines, and just utilize that profile with my actual name to skip trace through Facebook.
That's what we do also. We set up one under my Facebook is under my name, but for occupation, it shows I'm a professional hunter, which that's not a lie, is it? I am a professional hunter. We hunt the most dangerous prey on the face of the earth, man.
I'm going to let that sit there for a minute. Moving on, our next question. Do you have any particular suggestions for using the appropriate phrasing to ask a third party for telephone numbers, addresses, or places of employment?
If you ask directly, sometimes you don't get it. The way you verbiage it, and again, it's like when I'm tracing, I trace as Ronnie. Ronnie has a little higher voice, and rather than asking for, do you have their home telephone number, it'd be, hey, address over where their home is. Do you know where their house? You got to play it kind of. Don't ask direct questions. Well, you know, where's he working now? Or also, we use a stutter technique. Have you ever talked to someone who stutters, and you just want to answer the question for them? So we train our tracers also to use what's known as the stutter technique. And they say, does he still work down at and they'll tell you where they work. It's amazing. Does he still live over at and they'll jump right in there and give you the address. Nothing's 100%, remember, but that's some of the techniques that help us find people when other people can't.
Very clever. Is there any difference in applicable regulations if you're skipping an asset rather than a person?
I don't think there is. I think, you know, if you are skip tracing, if you're trying to find the asset to seize it, basically you're doing the same thing. You got to find the person to find their asset. I certainly follow the same guidelines when I'm skip tracing, trying to locate an asset, as I do the other. If it's a commercial account, I follow commercial guidelines for skip tracing. If it's a consumer account, we have to follow the consumer. That's our policy here. It may be different with other agencies.
Excellent. Well, we've reached the top of the hour and we're running out of time, but what I want to do before we hang up is maybe go around the room, go around the panel, Dwayne, Kelly, and Ron. David had to jump off had a hard stop at 2:00 for another appointment, and maybe just sort of summarize, offer any takeaways, any sort of most important tips, anything like that, that you want people to sort of walk away from this webinar with from today. And Dwayne, maybe we'll start with you.
Well, I'm obviously going to start using the stutter technique because that's a new one for me. So I will definitely give that a try. I think my takeaways would be, you know, utilize, you know, the read only. I don't know if I personally would set up my own personal Facebook and take a chance on that. But, you know, utilizing, you know, all the social media, but do it the right way. Read only is what I would suggest to you. If you don't have the technique to call and utilize that, then I would definitely stick with a safe passage for you. But odor collectors, if you've been in the game for a while, you definitely know how to talk and have conversation. And a lot of times when I utilize my technique, it's more of like an interview session with a third party, or it's an interview session with a consumer to get the information I need out of, you know, Q&A session, and honestly making them feel like that, that I care, for one thing, for the person I'm trying to reach. So my takeaways would be just, you know, follow FDCPA. If you don't know FDCPA, ask somebody, and definitely stay within the realms of doing everything by law, in my personal opinion.
Appreciate it, Dwayne. Thanks. Kelly, your turn.
I think we covered a lot of great things. I think practice is the thing that I want to kind of reiterate in this, is all these tools that we gave you are not going to work right away. You do have to practice them. If you haven't done a lot of verbal skip tracing, I'm going to give a shameless plug for Ron. He's got a great YouTube channel and tons of information on YouTube. His videos are really great. Utilize kind of some of his skills. My favorite one is when my husband asks if I took out the trash. I always look at him kind of strange and say, that's an interesting question. Why would you ask me that? And sometimes it gets me out of the trash duty at the house. So I appreciate that skill that Ron shared with me. But just really practice it. Practice it when you're sitting at a coffee shop. Practice it when you're in an airplane. Practice it with your kids. It's a lot of fun to start practicing these techniques, and they do. They work really well. And then I think I reiterate, read only. Just look at the information and find. Finally, I think that the FDCPA was started because they knew that there were ways that you can treat consumers with respect, and there were legal ways to collect bills. And I think that we can follow the law and still be successful at locating people and their information. And I think that for me, I think that's really important for us, our industry, to continue to fight the PR fight. It's important that we follow the rules and we can still be successful.
Love that. Ron, your turn.
I certainly agree with everything both my peers there said. They're well respected in the industry. I would say, you know, cyber tracking can only take you so far. And a lot of the people that we hunt you know, they don't have the Facebooks. They don't have the Twitters. They don't have computers, and they have throwaway telephones. So if you want to go beyond the cyber tracker point and become a real skip tracer, you've got to learn communication skills, learn neurolinguistic skills, learn the five most powerful words in the English language, and learn how to use those to get people to give you information. And never, ever, ever give up. Everybody is somewhere, and you can find them.
Excellent. Well, love that. That's where we're going to end today's webinar. I want to thank David, Kelly, Ron, and Dwayne for their insights and their time today. I really appreciate them sharing for no other reason than they're interested in helping the industry, which is awesome. I also wanted to thank MicroBuilt for sponsoring today's webinar. Again, you can go to microbuilt.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated. Thanks to everybody who asked questions. Recording of this event will be posted to accountsrecovery.net in the very near future. And I hope you stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars that are on the calendar as well. I hope everyone enjoys the rest of their day, your weekend. And if we don't talk to you before, have a great Thanksgiving holiday season. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Good luck and good hunting.
Thank you.